ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I don't know if we can blame Anthony Bourdain for contemporary culture's obsession with food, but if you are obsessed, if you've ever headed across town or across the world even, in order to come back with a story of how you ate that perfect Vietnamese dish or that sublime old school hamburger that you bought from a guy in a van by the side of some road somewhere, then I would say you've been very influenced by Anthony Bourdain's legacy. He is still a very relevant figure some 8 years after his tragic demise, and that is why someone has made a film about him. Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National, and the film is called Tony, and it's the first film we're going to talk about today. It is not about Anthony Bourdain's life. It is not the film that you might expect. It is a film about one summer before Anthony Bourdain knew much about cooking at all. He actually wanted two things in his life at this point. He didn't want anything to do with food. He wanted to get close to a girl named Nancy, and he wanted to become a writer. Both these desires saw him run away from home to Provincetown in Massachusetts in the mid-1970s, where Nancy had a holiday job at a pizza parlor, and Anthony Bourdain, then calling himself Tony, would find work in a hot, greasy kitchen at a seafood restaurant run by a super disciplined, devoutly Catholic Portuguese chef. And a warning, there's some strong language ahead.
We open Wednesday to Sunday, start 11 a.m.
What fucking time is it?
That means that you are here at 10:45. 11 is late. Anyone late is fired.
The director of Tony, who you're about to meet, is a Canadian by the name of Matt Johnson. And the only other film of his I've seen is the comedy drama about the guys who invented the BlackBerry mobile phone. It was called BlackBerry. It came out a few years ago. The star of Tony, who plays Anthony Bourdain, who you're also about to meet, is Dominic Sessa, a good-looking young man in a kind of brooding Led Zeppelin hair kind of way, who you might remember played the lead in the coming-of-age film with Paul Giamatti, The Holdovers. Now, Tony is a strange film because as much as it sets up a kind of dynamic, it's not actually about getting the girl as much as it's about the getting of wisdom. And it leans heavily on the reality TV tropes of nightmare kitchens. You know, the kind where hazing and verbal abuse are a perverse love language, apparently. Staff are frequently hungover, but soldier on regardless, and there's the constant danger of burning, scolding, cutting, or, as it happens in this kitchen, even overdosing. But it's this frenetic, steamy environment, commandeered by a veteran chef who turns a blind eye to a lot of the bad behaviour, played by Antonio Banderas, where the young Tony becomes Anthony. He comes of age, and he is struck by the discipline, the camaraderie, the heroism of his band of brothers and one sister in the restaurant. These include Leo Woodall, playing an Italian-American named Sal, Is There Anything He Can't Do?, and comedian Stavros Halkias. Plus, there's Monica Raymond as the restaurant's waitress, whose best scenes, unfortunately, appear to have been left on the cutting room floor. Now, if Tony didn't become Anthony, would we care about any of this? If we didn't know that Nancy, who's played very well by Emilia Jones, would end up becoming Anthony's first wife, would we be disappointed by the film's failure to close the romantic deal? Tony is a coming-of-age drama about a middling guy who fails just as much as he succeeds, and by the end of the film, still shows barely any indication he's going to end up achieving much in life at all. He's still no one you'd want to take your phone out of your pocket for and take a selfie with. The filmmaking, the writing, the direction are all fairly standard, but this one idea that Tony's greatest achievement is learning to stop telling tall stories to others, to himself, and embark eventually on a vocational path as a professional cook is the film's thoughtful takeaway. And in that process, I think the film successfully transforms a media icon that perhaps might seem a little two-dimensional into a character with everyday dimensions and depth. Director Matt Johnston, lead actor Dominic Sessa, and supporting actor Stavros Halkias coming up. A warning, there's some strong language ahead.
Let me teach you this. This is how you open an oyster.
I ate these in France when I was a kid. I said they taste like the future.
I was reminded every measure I got on fine with modern living.
This guy, he's like a master chef.
And the world still so wild called to me.
We're gonna start with this as special.
Every Friday, something fancy but not pretentious, something sexy makes you wanna fuck, you know? Something only you can do.
I was lost, I've been kept.
This is insane,
I know.
What's this?
That's for you.
And the world still so wild called to me.
If anybody asks, I'm not a writer. I work in a kitchen.
Sorry, what is your name?
Anthony Bourdain.
Guys, what do you think that fans of Anthony Bourdain will be, if there's one thing, what will they be surprised by, do you think, after watching this film?
That's impossible because, you know, I'll tell you, I've learned that Anthony Bourdain means something extremely specific to each person who loves him. Mm-hmm. And I think that because his life was on its surface, very in the open, like I let you see me, warts and all, here's everything that's wrong with me, here's everything I love. I don't want to say this negatively, but I think it also masked in some way who he was privately. And because of that, I think people are able to connect with him in an extremely personal way that even they can't explain. And so what will surprise them is probably them being confronted by a different interpretation of him as a young man. I don't think there's anything that when we were making the film, we were like, whoa, the fans are really going to react. Those conversations never happened once. In fact, we never even on set would have a conversation. I mean, this is more specific to Dom and I. But we never really thought, okay, so what would Anthony Bourdain say, think, do, right? Like we were making a character that was living inside of Dom and it was coming out of him. So I don't know that any of us can answer that because it wasn't something that we were thinking about.
Dom, do you think...
You must have an answer. What do you think?
I think one of the things that's really interesting is that how... I mean, I didn't realize he was really into wanting to be a writer. And I thought that that artistic side to him was really fascinating. But you know, he has this, obviously he had this self-destructive streak as well as being brilliant in many ways. I'm wondering, you know, what you think that streak was about. And Dom, if I could ask you, given that you inhabited this character for so long, you know, what do you think this film sheds? What light do you think this film sheds on that destructive streak and where that comes from, do you think, that darkness?
I don't know. I think... For Matt and I talked a lot about how this was kind of a pattern in his life, you know, like after 1975, like it was something that, you know, he struggled with addiction and then and other problems later in life. So he always kind of had this consistent, darkness in him in a way. And I think what was important, and I think what I hope people realize in this, you know, watching this movie is that there's a certain time in your life, especially when you're young, where it's critical to sort of address those things. And, you know, maybe for the character in the film, it seems that there's this overwhelming sense of hope in the end. But that's momentary. And I think you have to be very careful about, you know, later in life when those things that are so innate in you, and I think innate in everybody, if you don't take care with them in the proper way, it's can be detrimental. And I think that's something I was always reminding myself of and, you know, when playing the role. And I hope it's evident to people and people understand that when watching it. It's important.
And Matt, you've got this background in comedy and documentary as well. This obviously is, you know, we're dealing with the life of, an episode from the life of someone who had this dark side to him. But tell me about that balancing act. And Stavros, maybe I'm wondering if you could come in on this too, because your character is quite funny. Although there's not much funny about this kitchen. It's a pretty dysfunctional kitchen too. So maybe if I could start with you, Stavros, and then come to you, Matt, about this balancing of sort of comedy and physicality and kind of danger in the kitchen as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, my sort of role in this movie is to, I'm not concerned with the big picture stuff, right? That's on them. They have to figure out how to not piss off every Anthony Bourdain super fan. All I had to do was be these guys that I knew. You know, I grew up in Baltimore. My mom was a waitress in Greek restaurants. My dad was a contractor. And so I played, you know, I played a lot of sports growing up. I know a locker room. I know a break room. My first job was a machine shop owned by a Greek guy that made parts for guns. So like, I know what it's like to kind of bust balls and haze people and you know, I actually did relate the way my in to this version of Anthony Bourdain was his summer in the kitchen. To me, my first time starting comedy, I was 19, kind of around the same age as when he found the kitchen. And I, as corny as it is, starting stand up completely ordered my life, gave me like a purpose of
vision, wow.
Something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And I had these older guys that were really mean to me at first, and I hated them the first time I met them. And some of them went on to become my best friends. I mean, Bobby Kelly, one of my great mentors, I opened for him for years on the road. And I modeled some of that after Bobby. And just in general, you know, my dad's friends that would kind of mock you, but you knew at the end they would do anything for you, right? Like, and that's what I wanted to, that's the flavor I wanted to give to this, is to sort of put these guys on screen. And that's the sort of artsy way to put it. And the real way is like they hired me to bully Dom for 2 weeks. And I could do that. That's easy for me to do. That was no problem whatsoever. So that's sort of how I saw it. I'm here to like sort of put these guys that I grew up with on screen in a way that I know anyone who, you know, and my character was sort of an amalgamation of a few of the guys from the first chapters of Kitchen Confidential, but it was really like this movie kind of, I wanted to get the vibe of that guy right. For me, I was more concerned with the connection and the actual relationship to, you know, Dom's character. And that's how I approached it. And honestly, it was the easiest, it was so easy to do. We really just were back. When I was in that kitchen, I felt like I was in a locker room, like I was in a green room, and I was just kind of giving the new kid who I liked a hard time. Easy job for sure.
Yeah, tell me, I'm kind of interested in Nancy, Matt, in that, you know, a kind of conventional arc with Nancy would be like, you know, she wouldn't be as an unattainable, let's say, as she is in this film. And I don't want to give too much away. Tell me about that. I mean, given that everyone knows that she ends up being Anthony Bourdain's wife, but this isn't about that necessarily. It is about their meeting and he's infatuated with her, but you kind of hold back a little bit from that, if I'm explaining myself. I'm not wanting to give away spoilers. Tell me about the writing of that relationship.
It is so connected to what Stav was just talking about, which was, it's so interesting that Anthony Bourdain is writing about his life in Kitchen Confidential. And here he is with his girlfriend in Provincetown, who he's followed there and will later be his wife for 25 years. And yet 99% of the text is around these homosocial relationships that he has in these fraternal settings where he is being hazed, bullied, and humiliated into a profession that he didn't even want to be a part of. And what I took from that is something that I so related to, which is, well, one, let's not kid ourselves. Anthony Bourdain's sense of himself in the eyes of the women of his life, his mother, Nancy, later women that he would fall in love with, was very important to him. He took a huge amount of self-worth from those relationships. But he almost existed exclusively in male-only spaces. And so what I'm trying to do is show a kind of out of work, in work relationship that he has with his youth that will then go on to. Have you read the chapter in Kitchen Confidential where he said it's called The Day in the Life of a Chef?
No, I haven't read it.
This is worth any. It is worth your time. Everybody should read this chapter. It's unbelievable. It was first published as a magazine article, and really, it's the genesis of his adult identity. He writes this article for a magazine. It might have been New Yorker. I'm not sure. And he talks about what he does in a day. And it is just, and it is barely bookended by his time with his wife, Nancy. Mm. Barely, right? He wakes up and he talks about having his mind on something else while she is chatting with him in the morning before while he's smoking a cigarette, while really he's thinking about what orders he needs to make that day. And I don't know how to express it perfectly, but in that reflection of his own life, I thought, okay, so here is a guy who so loves the women in his life, but at the same time seems to constantly be retreating to these male spaces where he's spending all of his time. And so that was the decision there, to try to make that relationship with Emilia Jones as high stakes as possible for Dom, where it is literally the driving thing. It's why he went there. It's why he's working in the kitchen. It's why in many ways he wants to be famous so that this woman will accept him. And yet he can't even spend more than 5 or 6 uninterrupted minutes with her because it's too much. It's too much. He has to get away. Again, I can't even explain it because I don't even know if I understand it, but it seemed real to us. I hope that answers your question.
It does. And yeah. Dom, finally, did you learn to cook at all on set, or were you already a cook?
I mean, I worked in a bakery when I was younger, so I baked a lot of things. I know how to make donuts. Ooh. Stuff. Yeah.
Never gotten a cross donut.
We need different things. But Antonio Banderas was a really capable in the kitchen, and he actually taught me a lot personally. But before, no, I learned how to shuck oysters, actually. I went to, there's a restaurant in Prospect Park called Gertrude's. Mm-hmm. This guy, Eli Sussman, is a head chef there, owns the place. And he taught me how to shuck oysters.
Eli was extremely generous with that.
Yes.
He basically showing you all these guys.
Yeah. He showed me a lot around like the New York restaurant scene. Like it introduced me to a lot of restaurant owners and chefs. And just, you know, not that that was necessarily essential for me in doing the movie. It just was something that he was generous enough to teach me about, which was really cool.
And I will say, to add to that, it was actually important that for me, Dom didn't know how to cook, and I didn't want him to learn, because this movie is about a neophyte who is looking at this and really has no idea what he's doing. And it's kind of tough to fake. Once you become a master oyster shucker, once you really know your way around a kitchen, you're just not quite as awkward, which is really what we wanted him to be.
Well, look, it's been great speaking to you. And yeah, Dom, you're awkward, and I mean that in the best possible way. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
Have a good one.
Thanks, guys. Filmmaker Matt Johnson with his lead actor Dominic Sessa and supporting actor Stavros Halkias talking to me about Tony, the Anthony Bourdain biopic, which is releasing around the world currently. It's in cinemas in Australia later this month. Look out for it. You're listening to The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso, brought to you by ABC Radio National. Netflix is proposing a new adaptation of Miles Franklin's novel My Brilliant Career, the book that inspired Gillian Armstrong's landmark 1979 debut feature, which was invited to compete in competition at Cannes and catapulted its stars Judy Davis and the late Sam Neill to international fame. The new 6-part series releases this week, and I will review it on The Screen Show's TV spin-off The Couch with critic Wenli Ma. As I record this, we are still under embargo, so I can't give my review now. But what I can tell you is that this adaptation is an ambitious one. It attempts to modernize the story with an additional plot involving First Nations characters, in particular, a young horse handler, Nell, played by Sherrilee Watson, who you might remember was so great over at Stan's comedy adventure series, Thou Shalt Not Steal. If you haven't seen that, search it out. Nell, to some degree, reflects the headstrong character and convictions of the protagonist, Sybilla Melvin, who here is played by an excellent Philippa Northeast, and who you're about to meet. You'll recognise her from a host of shows, mainly on Australian television, from Home and Away to The Newsreader to that other Netflix production, Territory. Sam Neill's character, Harry Beecham, the love interest in the book, the film and the show, is played by Christopher Chung, a hunky landowner with a gym bod, and a character that's almost unrecognisable from the IT sleuth that Chung plays in Slow Horses. The main story of My Brilliant Career remains more or less the same, a romance of star-crossed lovers. Well, actually, there are two suitors, and it's all set against the backdrop of the social mores of turn of last century Australia, with its rigid, repressive gender roles, where marriage as an economic exchange was an institution of central importance. And so Sybilla, as a character, is quite the rebel. She's a young woman from a poor background who wants to write and not settle. And the men who turn her head in this show are a test of her determination to put her passion for writing ahead of love and certainly ahead of family pressure. The show is developed by veteran screenwriter and producer Liz Doran and directed by Alyssa McClelland and Anne Renton, who get good performances from a solid cast. You're about to meet the two leads, Philippa Northeast and Christopher Chung, after this clip.
I'm sure you'll make someone a lovely wife.
That's Granny's plan. It's not mine. I spend the mornings
by your side. Let's just hope there's a proposal coming. Is that all there is for me?
Where were you two?
She was perfectly safe
with you.
You're thinking about him, aren't you? How do you know if love is real? You sacrifice everything for it.
If my story had a man's name on it, they would never question my expertise.
What is that hiding away behind those eyes?
It's mostly concealed fury.
Are you ready?
Chris and Philippa, welcome to The Screen Show.
Hello.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How does it feel doing interviews about this show now? Because it's a solid chunk of work, isn't it? Is it something that you feel proud of? Are you exhausted by? Are you still sort of picking yourself up off the ground and sort of recovering from? Especially you, Philippa. I mean, it's such a huge role.
Yeah, it is. I think it certainly was my most athletic role, but I knew that going in based off the source material off the book. It's such a single vision female story. I knew that she was going to be in every scene, in every shooting day. And to be honest, as much as that was daunting, it was incredibly exciting. I think as an actor, you scream and you dream and you cry for that much time yeah. on set. And so to have that capacity to work within, and also I knew that that's what the story required, was it was an exciting challenge.
There's horses, there's a lot of running as well, Philippa. There's a couple of pretty serious sprints.
In
one of the episodes I remember, but there's horses and all sorts of other sort of trials and tribulations in the outback at the turn of last century. So it seems like a show where you had to really sort of muck in and get your hands dirty. I mean, Chris, you're on a few horses in this.
Yeah, I am. I only do shows that have some kind of relationship with horses.
I know.
So that's why I signed up to this one.
Horse Harry, we like to call him.
Did you know how to ride a horse before doing this show?
No, and it was actually one of the biggest appeals to come back and learn how to ride. We had an incredible horse master, Graham Ware, who I worked with in Sydney before we started principal photography. And then every morning before we started filming, I would go out with Sarah, and she would teach me how to go from a trot to a canter. Didn't quite get the gallop.
Oh, it looked like it.
Well,
just say it.
Philippa worked with Graham as well on Territory, so she's much more.
No, I just had known the horses because of Graham also being on Territory. So I was incredibly jealous when Chris was on Prince, who I had got to know on Territory. But luckily, I knew all the horses' favourite snacks. So even though I didn't get to ride as much as Chris, I could bribe them to love me.
Yeah, how hard is it working with horses? Because obviously they're so integral to this story, but also throughout the history of cinema and also small screen drama, you know, horses reappear and reappear. It seems like it's horse riding or knowing how to work with horses is almost a prerequisite for any actor who wants a serious career, because sometime in your career you're going to have to work with them.
Yeah, I think there's one scene specifically where in episode 5, where I come to Sibylla's house to tell her that I can't be with her anymore. And
Spoiler, sorry.
Read the book. and Prince the horse I was supposed to step off the horse, and he's supposed to stay there perfectly still while I deliver this moment to to Sybilla.
Which is a big moment.
Which is a big moment. And I'm doing my best and I'm acting my little socks off and he decides to go off on a little wander.
He was bored.
Cut.
He'd seen that before. He'd been there before.
And it's a good indication because they don't lie. If your acting's no good, they're not interested. They're off. They're out of it. So.
And now you only work for horses' admiration.
That's right.
A great barometer of performance.
But they are on that. That like these horses are. Yes, they do get bored, and they you know, like any of us, they've seen these scenes before, and they've got to find new ways to keep themselves busy and entertained. But they're incredible. They know how to reset themselves to first positions better than the actors. Mm-hmm. They know how to hit their marks. I would love to say that I'm a horse rider now, but I'm careful to say that I'm a show horse rider because I know that if I just jumped on any horse, they wouldn't be as trained as these horses are. They're better than any actor I've met at the technical side of things.
My Brilliant Career, of course, a really important book in the history of Australian literature, but an important film too, Gillian Anderson's film, such an iconic movie for the Australian film industry. Did you guys ever meet the actors who played your roles, either Judy Davis or the late Sam Neill?
I didn't actually get to meet Sam, but we had a few text exchanges through Kate Mulvaney, who plays my auntie. She was having lunch with Sam in Melbourne one weekend while we were filming, and she managed to get a video from him, I guess passing the baton over to me and saying that, you know, you've got him in hand, you can do it. And in turn, I sent him back a video in my Harry getup saying thank you and for thanking him for lending me Kate Mulvaney to play my aunt. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful man and he has incredibly big shoes to fill in that role. So to have that kind of blessing from him puts a lot of things at ease for me.
Yeah. And what about Judy Davis? Did you get to meet her?
No, I never met Judy Davis. I really admire her work across the board, but particularly in My Brilliant Career, and knowing that that was such an early piece for her that set her career on fire, really. I just have a really deep respect for the way that she entered the character and, yeah, honour that film as much as we now are making our own adaptation of the book and taking it to new places with a new spirit, but the same beating heart that Judy found and Sybilla is in the book.
Yeah. What were you told about why the filmmakers wanted to remake this for Netflix? What were you told about how it would be given a new life as a series?
Well, I think it's obviously the difference is that it's a six-part series, a six-part one-hour series. There's so much in the book. There's so much that you could expand on as well. And Liz and Alyssa and Chloe really wanted to extrapolate on certain parts of the book and also give them their own standalone episodes and time. And then also Chris can speak to this more, but I think it was important for the filmmakers to show an Australia that was true and authentic at the time in the 19th century. And we know that this book is written by a very young woman, the brilliant Miles Franklin, but there was more to the Australia of the time that we could expand upon. And this adaptation was ready for that and aimed to do that. So we have new storylines within it. And
yeah, I think when I came on board and I read the first few scripts, it was really profound to me how much Liz had managed to expand the world from the original novel while keeping the central message the same. The things that really appealed to me was the inclusion of the First Nations story and how she managed to incorporate that within the piece in a way that's not just put in there for no reason. It is really representative of the time, and the same with Harry's story being Chinese within that period of time in Australia and the things that he would have faced and the kind of prejudices. Those things really resonated with me in how the world really was back then. People have said, you know, there's a bit of colorblind casting going on within that. But for me personally, in fact, it's not at all. It is just representative and inclusive storytelling of a newer version of my brilliant career. So I think Liz, Alyssa and Chloe really have managed to take something that is so iconically Australian and so defining of a generation in the film from the 70s and bring it into the modern world now.
Yeah, and make it more accessible, I think, for many different generations. Obviously, we know we're going to have the generations that are such fans of the book and the film, but then hopefully we're going to be able to open this story up to a younger audience and an audience that might have not seen the film or read the book either, but still need this message.
And we're talking about, of course, executive producers Liz Doran, Alyssa McClelland, who's also a director, and the Chloe you mentioned is Chloe Rickard. It's interesting with you, Chris, especially because your career doesn't start off like a lot of Australian actors in terms of, you don't have that first role in an Australian soap. You kind of start in the UK, really. Which is different from you, Philippa. You do start on Home and Away. Tell me, Chris, what was it like sort of coming home in a way with a role like this?
Well, I did do one episode of Neighbours, so
I
was definitely in the background.
I have not seen it. I have to confess. Right.
Okay. I think if you blink, you'll miss me. But coming home to Australia to do a project like this was something that I had always hoped would happen with my career. I mean, I left in 2012 to try and seek out opportunities across the pond, and that happened for me. And having the ability to, I guess, build some kind of notoriety around my name to be able to bring me back to Australia to do a piece that I felt very passionate about was something that I had really made known to my team. So when my brilliant career came around, it's a big commitment to leave the UK, my wife, my dog, my home, my friends, and to come back for 4.5 months to film out in rural Adelaide. But it was everything that I would have hoped my first real Australian screen credit to be and more. So it was definitely a homecoming of the best sorts.
Mm. Yeah, he's quite a different character to the character you play in Slow Horses, isn't he? I mean, Harry Beecham is this kind of, he's got this gym bod and he's a heroic
leading
man.
It's the same body,
man.
You know that.
Right, okay. Yeah. So you didn't have to tone up because you play a kind of IT sleuth in Slow Horses who's he's a bit nerdy as a character.
Yeah, he's, I cover him up very well. But there was definitely a lot of preparation that I put into getting ready for Harry in terms of changing the kind of training that I was doing for the role. So it was very much more functional training to kind of mimic farm movements and pulling copious amounts of weight or throwing medicine balls and things that would emulate what Harry would have been doing on the land. So, yeah, it was definitely more kind of geared towards that. And in that way, yeah, the training was different from what I did for...
Strong handshake training.
Strong handshake training.
Not a carb in sight.
The catering on this job was absolutely...
Rachel Marcus, shout out.
Amazing.
The best caterer in all the lands.
Well, Adelaide... derailed me many times.
South Australia is known for its great produce, so I'm sure there's much of that.
Oh, it was beautiful. So the produce was amazing.
Whereabouts in South Australia exactly was it filmed?
We filmed in Panola... Harrogate near Mount Gambier.
Yeah.
Usually, the locations were about an hour and a bit out of Adelaide. We stayed in Adelaide. Yeah, all around South Australia.
Wow, the locations are fantastic for being so close to a major city like that, that you could actually stay and sleep in the city and then go out within an hour.
Yeah, I mean, that's the real blessing of runners and having a big crew and a big budget, to be honest, to be able to do that for Australia. But South Australia is one of those perfect places to shoot, I think, because you don't need to get that far out of the city in each direction and you're in entirely different landscapes. Yeah. So
I was so surprised by that because I just didn't realise that kind of landscape could exist so close to a major city.
Yeah, like you go to the hills, you go to the beach, you go to the desert in South Australia. It's pretty mind-blowing. Awesome.
Philippa and Chris, it's been really great to speak to you. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Philippa Northeast and Christopher Chung, two very talented Australian actors who star in the Netflix adaptation of My Brilliant Career. And to hear a review of that show once the embargo lifts, listen to ABC Radio National's weekly TV guide, The Couch, which is on air Wednesday morning after 10 on ABC Radio National, or look for The Couch on the webpage or in the podcast feed of this show, The Screen Show, with me, Jason DeRosso.
Out here, there are certain nights when you just get this feeling that some psycho killer is going to chop you up into a million little pieces. Oh, I like that feeling.
All right, time for a mention of one last film this week that's releasing in cinemas with the colourful title, if a bit hard to remember actually, Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma, a film that stars Gillian Anderson. It's by writer-director Jane Schoenbrunn, whose last film was I Saw the TV Glow. It had limited release a couple of years back. That was a supernatural horror dealing with themes of body dysphoria that reflected on Schoenbrunn's own experience of movie watching and TV watching as a queer trans kid. This new film centres once again on the profound imprint of movies on the psychosexual self, but this time it's about a 30-something filmmaker named Chris, played by Hannah Einbinder, and her encounter with the reclusive star of an 80s slasher movie franchise that she is set to reboot, Camp Miasma. Now, this is part Hollywood satire, it's part erotic thriller, but the film mainly concerns itself with deep questions of sexuality and identity, and it revels in a sort of knowing celebration of surfaces, textures, and artifice. It's something you notice from the get-go. It deploys obviously fake but evocative landscapes as backdrops. It uses intensely coloured convenience store candy as a recurring motif. Chris, the young director, unexpectedly runs into the aging movie star Billy Presley, played by Gillian Anderson, with a slow southern drawl, but thankfully few other affectations, while she's surveying the location where the original movies were set, on an alpine campsite. It turns out that Billy lives in a log cabin nearby, dressing glamorously for an audience that's not there. A bit like a slasher version of Sunset Boulevard's Norma Desmond. But unlike Norma, Billy Presley seems sure about who she is and even sure about what she can do for Chris. After they both bond over some quite strong weed, the young director reveals that she's pansexual but has always had a problem expressing intimacy. And from here, the story is basically about how Chris learns to stop overthinking with more than a little help from Billy. Things really go full horny cubist homage when the original 1980s Camp Miasma movie superimposes itself on the film we're watching. I don't mean that literally in terms of an optical effect. I mean that more figuratively. And it's via this blending of reality and fantasy and two different eras that we get to the nub of Chris's hang-up. Basically, a scene from the original first Camp Miasma movie that scarred her when she watched it as a child, when a slasher killer appears as Billy's character loses her virginity. Did I mention the slasher killer has an air conditioning duct for a head? I appreciate this might sound confusing and be really hard to follow without pictures. It's hard to find the words to explain it. But somewhere early on in this movie, it helps to follow the protagonist's lead and discard any over-intellectualizing. Jane Schoenbrunn has done all that thinking for you, and the result is a film layered with enough meaning for a student dissertation, but ultimately designed to be enjoyed or felt as an exercise in kitsch, metatextual horror homage, and embodied fun, both terrifying and erotic. The soundtrack, by the way, luxuriates in aural detail to help the erotic horror visuals land hard. Is it sometimes overwrought? Certainly. Does it sometimes forget how to be fun, even compelling? Yes. But it's a work of considerable texture and scope, with two excellent lead performances to carry it along, bloodied, but ultimately still standing. Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma is in cinemas now.
I don't want to make another dumb sequel in the Camp Miasma franchise. I don't want to make a remake of a remake of a remake. I want to make something that feels fresh and new.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
She's clearly the same person from Miasma 1, the final girl, but she's so much more.
you choose to live at the abandoned sleepaway camp from the first film?
Someone's gotta be here when Little Death comes back.
Little Death isn't real.
Well, not with that attitude, he isn't.
Well, that's it from me for another episode of The Screen Show. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed having your company. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett and to the ABC Radio National arts editor, Rhiannon Brown. I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.